Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. So this episode is part two of a maybe multi-part series, I am not certain, at least two-part series that I'm doing on my medical family. So you hopefully have already heard the first part where I interviewed my great uncle Jack, who is a physician in my family. And in this episode, I have another special guest, which is my father, Dr. David Chan. And this one might take you a little bit longer to get through. I haven't actually fully finished editing it, but I am editing down a 2-hour long recording. It actually was 1 hour in two parts. And I thought I would start this episode by talking through kind of what happened through the process of making this episode, because I think it speaks to some of the themes that you will hear then in the episode itself. So as you may have heard from the first episode with my great uncle Jack, my goal for this series is not to like air my family's dirty laundry or cause drama or anything, but simply to talk about what comes up in a family that has a lot of healthcare professionals. In our family, we have quite a few physicians as well as some nurses. And so when I first approached my dad, I shared those same questions with him. So questions about what made him get into medicine, questions about, you know, how he stays human in healthcare. And we talked for an hour, and my dad's a storyteller and a teacher. So he provided lots of detailed stories and examples and anecdotes from his long career in medicine. And that was interesting. And at the end of it, actually after we stopped recording, I then had a more personal conversation with my dad. And that conversation revealed to me that I was really missing and kind of tiptoeing around a big piece of what is tricky about our medical family. And so I proposed to him if he would be interested and willing to talk about some of the trickier parts of us being the family that we are. He agreed to do it. So then we had a whole second hour long conversation that was about those tricky parts. Specifically, the way I framed it to him, and I think I even say it later in this episode to him, one of the things that I used to really appreciate about the fact that there were so many physicians in our family is that even when we disagreed on other things like religion or politics, which are things that we do not all agree on in our family, we could still talk about medicine and kind of share similar views and, like, you know, talk about cases and that sort of thing. And that felt comforting to me, especially when other views of mine like diverged from my parents. And then COVID-19 pandemic began, and it became clearer that even within medicine, myself and my parents were really holding different views of that as well. And that was hard for me. And I wanted to hear from his perspective what it was like for him. And so that's actually what the second hour is all about, is his perspective and experience, you know, being a physician and also someone of the Catholic faith now, and how those things intertwined and caused tension as he was formulating his views of the pandemic in general, public health guidance, and the vaccine specifically. And so you're going to hear excerpts from those two conversations. I'm not airing the entire 2 hours. I just am aware that that's too long. I hope that I still captured the spirit of it. So just to share what my goal is for this episode, I think my goal is to share some of my dad's journey to becoming a doctor and his career in medicine, because I think it is always interesting to hear how different those careers can be. I think a lot of us think that medicine has to look one way and we have to sign up for the same job forever. But actually, you can do many, many things within healthcare, not just for physicians, but many people in healthcare. There's a lot of more flexibility than we think, and certainly for physicians. I wanted to share what he had shared as his insights of lessons he's learned along the way. And so I hope I still captured those pieces in what I've included. And then I also did want to include what his experience was like as he realized that he did not have the dominant views of COVID-19 pandemic. But there were pieces of what he was sharing, including, you know, some of his views and review of the data in his experience and in, from his perspective. And so I didn't include all of that. I was really mostly focused on like the social and emotional impact of that time for him, and also getting to talk about it a bit with him, like what that impact was for me. So having said that, depending on your past experiences and your views, I don't know, you might find parts of this conversation challenging. Maybe if you just have like dad-daughter stuff, you might find it challenging to hear a dad and daughter talking about what's tricky between them. If you feel very, very strongly about religion, if you feel very, very strongly about the COVID-19 vaccine or the pandemic or that sort of thing, I don't know. I guess I don't give this content warning at the beginning of all of my podcasts, and there's always something that could upset you, but I just think these issues were very, very heated for a long time, and in some ways still are heated. So I just want to let you know that that's some of the content that you're about to listen to, and so you can decide for yourself how much you want to listen and not listen. I'm not using this podcast. I didn't use this podcast in this conversation to get into like a debate or do like whatever fact checking means, you know. I really wanted to hear what his experience was like just over this time period, because as I say in the episode, I made the decision to ask my parents not to talk about it because I found it upsetting at the time. And so that's some of what you're going to listen to. At the end of this podcast, I am going to come back on after I'm done editing and sort of reflecting, and I'm going to share some of like the themes that came up for me as I participated in this conversation and edited it, and like what it means to me. So if you're interested in that, make sure you do listen all the way to the end. But in the meantime, I'm happy to introduce to you my father, Dr. David Chan. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. So my guest today is not just any old physician. This is my father that we have on the podcast today. And he's graciously agreed to be interviewed as a part of the series I'm doing about the fact that I come from a very medical family. And a lot of that medical family as actually through my mom's side, but and yet also my dad is also a physician. So would you like to introduce yourself, but like anything you want to say about who you are, what's your name, and tell me.
Okay, so my name is David Hong Chi Chan. I do have a Chinese name and it's in my passport. I came from Hong Kong. I went to the United States to do an undergraduate studies in electrical engineering. That was my background. And then I immigrated to Canada with the help of my company. And then at some point I decided to go back to school. And medical school was one of the options. And I got in and worked my way through, and I was on faculty at McMaster for a couple of decades at least, and retired in 2016 as a professor in family medicine. And then I had a bike accident and had a head injury, and so I was forced to basically not work for quite some time. I continued to work in a nursing home, which I started at least 2-3 decades before as a medical director for a nursing home. And I had a teaching, still had a part-time teaching job in that McMaster sent the residents there as part of their long-term care or care of the elderly training. And I did that for quite a while. And then different opportunities came. For example, right now, I'm actually one week of every 4 weeks, I would work in a hospice. Mm-hmm. It's going to be one of my points about don't worry about, you have to be flexible about your career.
Yes.
And I also still have patients in one retirement home whom you just cannot put them away. You know, there's nobody want them, right? Mm. And they're aging just like I'm aging, and this is where I'm at right now. You know, I've been babysitting grandchildren, and it's another one of those very fulfilling jobs.
I think actually, well, one other piece, if you want to talk about a bit, but I know was significant over your career is, while you had a full family practice, you also developed an EMR. So I don't know if you want to, I mean, you could talk about that forever, I know, but like, I think that is really interesting how you not only decided to practice medicine, but you decided to teach as well as did some like technological innovation. And is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, I mean, I was trained as a software engineer. And this is the day with only mainframe, no mini computer, no micro computer. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I was fortunate. I mean, I stayed in touch with the technology change. You know, first one would be just a mini, the computers get smaller and more powerful. And then the other one is on, you know, the arrival of the internet. I mean, trust me, when I was teaching my very first job to try to learn the latest PubMed thing, we wait for a CD to arrive every 6 months, right? And wow. Then, I mean, that's how you search, right? Anyway, so it was always the need for my academic career. My first job was a lecturer in the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And I need research to, you know, in an academic setting. Yep. So I developed the very first electronic medical record using an XT. You wouldn't even know. I mean, these are old machines, very, very slow, right? But I got a publication that is, you know, in family medicine, a very well known publication, and suddenly I got famous. I was invited to go to Australia in a computer conference for general practitioners, and you know, I was giving talks on it, and it became very famous in Australia. For the first time, I realized the reason partly I became quite famous was that the software I wrote was free.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had no understanding of all the intellectual property thing in the world. All I knew was it helped me, and if it helps you, please help yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And it was an eye-opener for me, the idea of freeware, shareware. You know, there are all kinds of names that are attached to it. Until later on, I learned the intricacies of intellectual property. You know, this whole area of called open source software.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then I my next job was at McGill University. Again, it was at a time we had so little resources. I came out of a community grant, but McGill, just like anywhere else, they had nothing. They had no computerized record. And, you know, I'm old enough to tell you, all those days, you don't, you know, it would be extremely very big department like in the U.S. that they would be able to afford something like this. So I more or less used what I did in Hong Kong. And and gave it a name in McGill. It's called Muffin.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because I call all the children my muffins. And so it's called McGill University Family Voter Information Network. I mean, and so so that was that at McGill, and I became, you know, as the creator of Muffin. So so then I, for a reason that I only would say, you know, okay, I was burned out. I had three kids. McGill was treating me very well, but I needed to come back to Ontario, where I started. And my wife's parents were close by. And so I said, you know, let's move back, because I was feeling the overwhelming, you know, it's just unbelievable. Simple things like a snowstorm in McGill is very common, but the snow can cover your car. You can't find it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I still remember I completely freaked out, you know, when my wife called me and said, I locked the kid in the car in a freezing weather. So you can imagine what it was like.
Yeah.
So I left. Mm-hmm. And then at McMaster, it's the same thing. You know, this is year 2000. Mm-hmm. We were facing this Y2K problem. Okay, you may or may not remember this.
I remember.
McMaster had a system paid for by the government in the tune of $1 million, but that particular piece of software is not Y2K survivable.
Oh, no.
And the joke was, you know, I got my blood, literally my blood, in almost all the computers. Because when I had to modernize this machine, $1 million is gone, there's no money. Mm-hmm. I had to upgrade the individual components of these computer, and they're terrible when you work with pulling carts out, I mean, you get cut all the time, right? And anyway, so I developed this software, and with that, you know, we had to pick a name for this new software that was uniquely suitable, right? And we try to use Muffin because McMaster University, McGill University, everything is the same. Wouldn't you believe McGill would not allow us?
Oh, brother. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I learned about these trade, you know, this copyright and intellectual property thing, including the name. So what name should we give it? Right? I mean, we went through a round of soul searching. I said, okay, you have to get rid of the university's name. Well, with that, you might as well get rid of the country's name, right? So we come up with the OSCAR, which stands for Open Source Computerized, what is it? Application and resource, right? Because it's become way more than just an electronic medical record, because we were making decision supports and stuff like that. So that was
That's the origin story. You know, I think I've heard most of those pieces, but I don't think I've heard it all in one go. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. And Oscar. Of course, OSCAR has been around now. It's one of the most popular ones across the country, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, so like, I'd love to hear more about your personal origins for why you decided to switch to medicine.
I graduated, from the U.S. and I got a job in the U.S. and then the job moved me to Canada and also for my immigration, and, became Canadian, you know, through work.
Yeah.
And, but it was, as an engineer, I was becoming very restless, and living in a town called Sarnia. I hope your audience is not from Sarnia, but I was single and I was restless. Okay, yeah. And I was, and I needed to get out. So I went to Ottawa, working for then the second largest computer company in the world called Digital Equipment. It's just bluntly, okay. Mm-hmm. I picked that job partly because I felt very wanting to settle down.
Yes.
And I heard, statistically speaking, there are more women in Ottawa because of government job. Now, I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, you got to go where the ladies are.
Yeah. I mean, it's Well, anyway, so I went there, but on my way there, I visited, in Chinese, I call her my cousin, but there's no blood relationship, but because through this and that, you know, and they are very fervent Protestant Christians, and they said, oh, okay, well, you know, they were reaching out to me. And so when you get to Ottawa, you must make sure to find our friends. So in Ottawa, I went to this church because of, you know, I had no friend, nobody, right? Yeah. So I was invited right away, and they received me in their home. They feed me meals and looked after, you know, there are many new friends that I've found in that church. Through the church, I become what you would call a born-again Christian. Mm-hmm. And I was very, like everything that I do, I tend to be very jump right in, like 100%, or otherwise forget it, right?
Yeah.
And I went to one of the retreats. Now, this all seemed to be so distant from what your question is. But in that retreat, I was completely blown away how people want to use their life for a good purpose. Mm-hmm. And one story I heard was that there are five missionary doctors killed in an accident in Thailand with their children. Altogether, 11 people were killed. Okay. And typical of me, I thought, well, somebody had to replace them. You know, I'm not kidding. You know, so I own my house. I own a sports car. Mm-hmm. I have a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. And I decided, okay, I'll go to med school. I mean,
that's how you decided.
Now, firstly, I was restless, like typical of me. I got into the PhD program at U of T in biomedical engineering. Mm-hmm. But when I talked to these good friends who are doctors, who said, well, if you're interested in research, you should get an MD first. Mm-hmm. Because you get more chances for grants and you understand the clinical processes and everything. So I said, oh, why not? So I, but anyway, so I am very fortunate. Yeah, I got into U of T, and that's how I got in. Now,
that actually. As you know, that my podcast is all about the fact that a lot of times, both the way we're trained and what patients or colleagues or society expects from us can make us forget that we're human beings and human bodies, and we can feel a bit disconnected from our humanity or disconnected from our purpose, you know, what matters to us. And so I'm wondering, first of all, did you struggle with that at all? And how you stayed connected to your humanity as you went through your years in medical practice?
Well, through the training program first, right? It's I learned quickly, there's no point, you know, going to a lot of the lectures. You know, I was given a stack of notes for every module. Mm-hmm. Why? And the exam is multiple choice. It comes right out of it. You just learn it, right?
Yeah.
So I was involved with other people's lives. You know, sometimes I was the president of the Chinese Christian Fellowship, and every so often you hear, you know, so and so is down, not very happy, you know, and then you learn those things. I live in Chinatown, I know that I wasn't, you know, I was still kind of like an engineer. You know, if somebody would tell me that, oh, I'm depressed, I would look at that person in the face. I had no idea what it's like to be depressed. I would say, oh, okay, and then you change subjects, you know, because you were not trained, and part of that. Medicine training, especially family medicine training, is it helped me to get a better person. I thought I would be fantastic going to radiology because I already knew about Fourier transform and all the computer, you know, all the CAT scan, and you know, I had the principles of it, right? I thought I would, and when I discovered you have to do 3 years and you know, you have to go to internal medicine and you have to do this and that, I said, oh well, which one is the shortest one? It was the family medicine, but little do I know, it was exactly the right thing for me because I need to grow as a person.
Yeah,
learn how to listen, learn how to say things, and not that I, you know, I'm doing perfectly, but I'm just saying, mm-hmm. the training was fantastic. After McGill, I used the word, I felt burned out,
yeah.
and came back to Ontario. And the first job I got was not at McMaster, right? It was at a psych hospital,
right?
Where I became the medical director for medical surgical services first, and then I actually ran a program, geriatric psychiatry. And also on top of that, I had, you know, I learned how to be efficient with my time. Mm-hmm. I actually went back to grad school and I actually got a degree in clinical epidemiology. I call those 7 years working in the psychiatric hospital my sabbatical, actually. It was what I needed. Mm. Right? And then, of course, I got brought into McMaster's family medicine program. Yeah.
So the last question I'm asking in this series is what it's like being in a family that's full of doctors. And so for you, so your younger brother became a doctor as well. But really it's that you married.
He was ahead of me by 1 year.
So okay. So then he got there first. So there was that. And you married into, well, you haven't actually, but you met your wife in medical school.
Medical school, yeah.
Yes. And
that's why you go to medical school. That's we were joking around with these students, right? You
know, yes.
Because you find the best, you know, in medical school.
That's how you get your spouse. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, what has been your experience being in this family that is so full of physicians? Is there any, like, especially it's sort of interesting, like you married into the family and then suddenly there's all these people that are doctors, you know,
yeah.
What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, initially I thought it was perfect because my wife also wanted to be a missionary. So in fact, that was a mutual point of my marriage. It was a kind of an internal agreement that that's what we do when we finish. That's what we do, right? Mm-hmm. And then we ended up teaching in Hong Kong. So it was very unfair to her because although I do think of it as really originally part of our goal, and she was learning Chinese, right?
Yeah.
On the side. I mean, that's what she would have wanted to do, but she couldn't practice. You know, by then we had wrong information. You know, Hong Kong, we were going through this refugee crisis from Vietnam. There were huge camps in Hong Kong. There were Vietnamese, and they needed doctors. And I learned from a doctor, an ER doc in Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He said, "Oh yeah, I went there and I was I volunteered. You know, I didn't even get paid, and that was fine. And that would have been perfect." But when we arrived, oh no, they only want to use Hong Kong graduates. Mm. And they pay them to do that work. And so she ended up having two kids in Hong Kong, and you're the first one. And I could have done better in terms of knowing how difficult it was for her, mm-hmm. how important medicine is to her. And family support, you know, you just don't end up in a place in Hong Kong. And my very traditional head is that, we can't leave until I find another job, right?
Right.
Because somebody's had to pay for the growing family. But it took me another year to get a job offer from McGill.
Okay, yeah.
But that third year was very hard. Mm-hmm. I still regret. Maybe I should have said, heck with this. I mean, I've always had a strong ego. I mean, my nickname is Proud Chan, you know, Chan Chan. When I share this with other people, oh no, you're not like that. Oh yeah, I was, right? Mm-hmm. And I continue to be in my head anyways, right? Mm-hmm. So having, you know, orthopedic brother-in-law, pediatrician, uncle, mm-hmm. All of those things didn't matter to me a lot. You know, I feel very confident about my training and my work and mostly my love for my clinical work, my patients. You know, I don't think you could be anything to feel, you know, oh, well, they must be smarter or brighter. No, I don't have any of those pressures, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, The medical family was difficult, but I hope you can probably tell, you know, did we ignore, you know, your piano lessons, your ballet lessons, you know, we try our best, right?
Yeah.
And we always focus on our other non-medical life that we draw strength from. Yeah. For example, our church life, it's very important to us, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm continuing to learn that we have to make decisions together. You know, always respect your spouse and trying to always have some compromise.
So people listening usually are listening to the podcast because they are feeling burnt out or feeling a bit disconnected from their purpose, their humanity. And they might be feeling a bit overwhelmed or burnt out themselves. So I'm curious if you have any words of encouragement or advice to offer to them.
Well, I wrote down a little list because you gave me this.
I'm waiting for the list. Well,
live simply. Mm-hmm. You know, so for a long time we drove an old clunker. What do, right? My first job paid less than being a resident. And we live in basically a subsidized housing, you know, although I was telling you how beautiful it was.
Yeah.
But we kept the furniture that they gave us. They were made by prisoners, and anybody who visited us would say, oh, you can afford better than that. Well, we were happy. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were cheap furniture. And not to make any major financial thing if you don't have to. I mean, we're still living in the very single one house that we ever bought. We still live in this house, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have to worry about constantly remortgaging and this and that, right?
Yeah.
Because those things can really break relationships, you know, if you add too much of it. You know, we call it the critical life. You know, I mean, there are weights assigned to these things. If you do too many of them, you're guaranteed to be sick. Critical life events, like for something like that, right? Keep your end goal. For me, you know, why you're living, you know, those very fundamental things. Mm-hmm. What brings you, you know, I would rank peace higher than happiness, because happiness is just so evasive. Mm. You know, just having, knowing that you're at the right place. Mm. Try to make decisions together, support from extended family. One of the smartest things that I did was leave McGill after only 2 years, right? But here we have my wife's extended family, you know, babysitting and do, you know, when we had urgent thing, one of the kids got sick, somebody has to stay home, right? Things like that. The flexibility in career plan, huge. You'd be amazed, you know, when you're trained and have the intellectual ability as a doctor, you can do just about anything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And church involvement in our case, but whatever community support group, right? Book club, whatever it is, friendships.
Some kind of life outside of medicine, hey? Like that makes a big difference.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, as you know, I learned this from your mother, the exercise. You know, I was not a slouch, but I, you know, she dragged me into running, you know, because she was so accomplished in running.
Yeah.
And it was just one of the best things in life. To this day, I'm not bragging about it. You know, I ran 2 marathons. I did a half Ironman.
Yeah.
Totally beyond my imagination, but only because there are friends, groups that are doing it. And no matter how you feel, you come home and say, do I have to go to this, you know, run, right?
Yeah.
Well, people are waiting for you, right? So it's you know, you may find other stress-relieving thing, but for us, this whole thing of exercising, I mean, to this day, I mean, even though I had both of my knees replaced, I still go out cycling almost every day. You know, it's almost spiritual, mysterious. The wind blowing on your face.
Yes.
And you see, you know, just completely just out of your box of whatever worries and everything. You're out there. But anyways, it's it's just you pick in your own mind, you know, what it is, and you just go and enjoy it, right? Always keep life in proper perspective.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of those stories, Dad. You have been many places and have experienced a lot in your lifetime, and I hope that's really interesting to the people who are listening, and also inspiring in the sense of exactly like what you said. If you feel like you're stuck or you're trapped, there's so many ways you can go. You can change your mind a million times, right? Like you had many career deviations, and they all ended up being, it got you where you are now, you know? Okay. Hi, Dad.
Hi.
So this is a second part of our podcast interview after we had our first conversation a couple weeks ago. I realized after that there was another piece to the way that we have been a medical family, in our medical family, that if you were comfortable to share, I think would be really interesting to share, because I imagine that similar conversations and similar things may have happened in other families over the time period we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. So to sort of frame it, the thing I was thinking about for myself, reflecting on like, what's it like to be in this family of physicians? Cause there's so many of us in our family. And one thing that I used to say was, well, we just always have that to talk about in common. Like at the dinner table, we can just talk about medicine and kind of laugh about gory, gucky things. And that was true until there was a period of time where, at least for me in my own mind, it felt less true. And that was during the COVID-19 pandemic, because different members of our family, including like yourself in relationship to me, held different views of what was true or what was right, or I don't know what the great, what had different positions, perspectives on what was happening in the COVID-19 pandemic. And I know for me that felt sad and hard, because it's nice to have things to connect with in a family. And that was really challenging for me to experience. And I was actually curious, the purpose of this conversation is not to then like debate each other about our any differences of opinion or anything like that, but more to talk about, I would like to hear from your perspective what the like emotional impact, the human impact was on you being a physician who was looking at the COVID-19 pandemic and seeing it differently than your colleagues and your daughter, who's a physician, you know, some people like that. And so that's what I hope this conversation can be about. And that's what you agreed to, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So the first question I wanted to start with is, when did you first recognize that at least some of your opinions or perspectives or beliefs around COVID-19 were differing from those of the colleague, or I'm going to put in quotes, mainstream? When did you start to notice that you were seeing things differently than a lot of like the dominant messages you were hearing about the pandemic?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think for your audience, you know, I'm not sort of bragging about it, but to get some background, right?
Sure.
I was a professor in family medicine. I taught, you know, residents, and I was a medical director of a big teaching clinic. Yeah. And I was a medical director of a nursing home, involved in being the infection control and all that. And on top of that, part of my training was a degree from McMaster called Design, Measurement, and Evaluation. It's a clinical epidemiology degree. And I've been a teacher in evidence-based medicine for decades. So all of that in the background, just to say, when it all started, you know, late, when we first heard news about it, and late 2019, early 2020, I was just like, what I was before, you know, I said, wow, this is terrible. You know, I'm going to, you know, I've dealt with, off often just outbreaks within nursing home or within facilities, right? I just know that it's going to be tough facing all that. So I still remember being, you know, very obsessed about, you know, what the public health is saying. One of our, you know, my wife and I would glue to the TV screen about this White House daily broadcast. I mean, and to be honest with you, in the beginning, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Baer, they were a bit of our heroes because they represent to us very prominent full of experience, especially Dr. Berg. I mean, she was supposed to be an HIV expert and all that, right? And so I was already, I have never been like an anti-vaxxer or even hold any position like that. I was teaching all my residents, you know, following guidelines, doing all the right thing. And so I had no difficulty accepting if this brilliant, you know, turbo vaccine or, you know, or whatever they call it, you know, very quick development of it. Like everything else, I'll be the first one, you know, in my facility to take it, right? To encourage other people to do the same. I mean, that's what I did for flu vaccine. You know, there's some quarter percentage of the staff in nursing home refused the vaccine.
Yeah.
And as much as you respect their decision, you just think that, well, if you work in a high-risk facility, you know, you really have to think about the patients, right? But anyway, so that was the beginning. And then, you know, what started to change was that I think I may have mentioned this last time, but I became a Catholic. So I suddenly had very, you know, I mean, I typical of me, when I jump into something, I just jump. My whole body and soul, everything jumped in. And the whole idea of whether vaccine can be, like aborted fetal tissues for either experimentation or for production of vaccine, or even for testing, because they can't always use human bodies to test. Well, I was, to be honest with you, I was much still half-hearted. You know, I said, well, you know, okay, the church in general, coming all the way from the Pope, had said that you have to do the right thing. You know, you have to be vaccinated for the love of your family, right? All that. Now, we were requested to do workshops. You know, we talked to a large group of Hamilton Catholic doctors in a session. And another one in an even bigger group in Toronto. And we were forced to really look at this thing more face-to-face because we understand that there are, you know, the reason why it was popular was that people really do hold very different views, especially from a religious perspective. You know, at that point, you know, your mom and I held a very strong view about the church's teaching on life issue, dignity of life. So we say to ourselves, well, we are afraid, but we're not that afraid, because by then the data has come out that the people hurt by it are really the people who are old and have comorbidities, and, you know, For younger people, really the effect of it is not bad.
Effective, and so I feel COVID or the vaccine?
COVID.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the COVID. I mean, it's a very bad virus, highly contagious, and it's spread by wildfire, right? I mean, if it happened to enter into my nursing home, boom, you know, whole place has shut down, right?
Yeah.
And so, but for ourselves, to try to satisfy our own religious conviction, we would choose to wait. Like, I mean, I would be careful, but if you ever been in my EBM class, evidence-based medicine class, you would know that I'm a kind of a big believer of of not believing in hard numbers, because in medicine, we're highly variable. There's so many different things that affect our health. You know, to make even as common as blood pressure 149, I have a lot of arguments about the evidence.
Yeah.
So the idea of a 6 foot distancing, wearing a mask that I know, you know, after having to been to hospital, you know, testing for N95, you know, these ordinary masks, they're just not useful, right? So,
Dad, I do want to make sure we have time to talk more about the impact it had on you. I know you're a teacher, so you can't help but share the EBM of it. And I do want to make sure that I would love to focus on how it felt for you as you are doing this analysis and you're even giving these workshops and you're coming to different conclusions than what the recommendations are. So you're viewing not safe, not effective, and yet that's what is being said and it's being encouraged. So I'm curious, like, what it felt like to be in that position where your analysis and what you and your peers are coming to a conclusion about, or even just you and mom or whoever, and you're deciding to wait. Like, what did that feel like to have this different position than what was being recommended, which was to take the COVID-19 vaccine?
Okay. Yeah. So as a start, even well-meaning Catholic doctors in these lectures gave us feedback. One couple, brand new graduate, was accusing us for causing harm for these lectures, just talking about it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we were, of course, feeling, okay, should we have kept our mouth shut, right? Mm-hmm. Should we just go with the mainline thing, you know?
Yeah.
Lovely neighbor, you know. So that was kind of tough, but we kind of sucked it up. We realized that this is going to happen more and more. Now, we had signed up, meaning your mom and I, have signed up to this Great Barrington Declaration. You mean,
yes.
You're not heard about it.
Yes.
I mean, three very prominent scientists that I have huge respect for essentially tell us, and that's my guiding principle, is that you focus on those who are at risk, but don't abandon the entire society, because there is never any evidence that actually works, even with herd immunity, because of the virus rapid, you know, any coronavirus, we just have never had herd immunity. Okay, never, right? Common cold is commonest. But anyway, so we just kept things quiet to ourselves, except that, you know what, some of our best friends in the Catholic and the Protestant community that we know, they would talk about, you know, being involved in all the immunization program, really pushing hard, and a couple of them are very afraid. They are, you know, mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues tend to be older, but they are so afraid. And yet we couldn't really tell them honestly, yes, you know, it's a bad thing, but there are also treatments. Now, I'm not going to go into that, right? Mm-hmm. But we have actually looked at treatment, and in the sense that the healthcare system was completely in the wrong place, pushing for ventilators and pushing for antiviral drugs, expensive ones from these same pharma, right? And instead of, again, we started looking for other colleagues who speak out loudly. We were convinced, you know, because some of these, they're repurposed drugs, so they've been around for a long, long time. Lots of meta-analysis, lots of good data. So we would rely on this and take precaution that way. But we would never be able to tell anybody. Like if you mention the word ivermectin, I mean, you can have your license taken away. You know, I mean, it's we have a college there, it's very militant. So as you know, you may not know. But I mean, they, So we feel that we now kind of live in a kind of under a huge repression of, suppression of what we believe in, and we weren't given the freedom for it. So we couldn't go to restaurants. In fact, we couldn't travel, and including our aging aunt in Arizona, right? And we just couldn't. The most despicable thing that I went through is that I've been a medical director for this nursing home for decades. I've outlived many of the executive directors. So when this mandate comes in, I try my best. I actually found a replacement for me. I'll take a leave of absence until my vaccine arrives or when the mandate, is removed after the peak season, right? Mm-hmm. And I introduced that person who is very good. And then shortly after that, I received a letter basically saying your employment is no longer good, right?
Yeah.
And so I was kind of, taken aback because I've been there for decades. And within the family, as you know, all of us were under such pressure, your aunt were interested to hear what we have to say. So we always, have some conversation, right? Mm-hmm. But then she is much more in taking, from our information, then she just really angry what she has to go through and fearful of she may be getting some of these side effects. Okay. And then, your uncle, the whole, the one in the retirement home, all the testing, which by the way, now I'm not going to talk any more about EBM, except for using the PCR test for a symptomatic person. It's like when you may or may not remember going through these clinical epidemiology modules as part of your training, you do not use a test to confirm, a sick person. To use it to screen an asymptomatic person because it leads to a lot of false positives. Okay, I'm stopping right there, right? Mm-hmm. So, so we went through a time we had not much work to do, and we got involved in people who were like us. We went to a conference in New Brunswick, Freedom Conference in Medicine, right? We have parties in Hamilton. There are people like us talking. It's just very bizarre. Okay, you go to these things, everybody was telling you they've known a friend, this and that. None of us were at the extent that we were going to be, holding plaques on the streets. But they are super keen bunch of people. But hard to talk to people who you have so much respect.
Yeah.
I had a classmate from high school. He was a Caltech professor in mathematics. And yet, you cannot help but when you're in the same car, it's not like I bring up these topics. He brought it up and say the vaccine has been so good, save lives and all that. But it doesn't make sense. It's very irrational. Anyway, so I don't want to go into this again, but When you are like that, you feel, okay, we'll just keep my mouth shut. In fact, I was in a listserv mm-hmm. with all my high school classmates. We have a very cohesive, I came from a very famous, Catholic high school. And all, I would say the majority of people are very accomplished. I'm talking about all these bright people. But one time we got in an argument. In fact, one of my buddy, who's a PhD in pharmacology, he worked for Pfizer. Mm-hmm. And he was in this group, and he and I got into a kind of debate. And then some guy said, "David, we know how you're feeling, but I don't think you should." I mean, just me, rather than the two of us engaging in this, right? So obviously, I kind of got, I was put in my place. I rarely contribute much to that WhatsApp group anymore. So it represents a very confusing time for me. people are very irrational. They're not interested to really hear about other perspective, whether they represent the truth or not. But, you know, it's a different perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that was when, now we're into the end of 2020. But I mean, I would, you know, for example, I have a bit of a reputation within this community. So I would get a call, a truck driver was sent home from the emergency room. He was not vaccinated. So they sent him home. You know, until you're blue, don't come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very sad scenario. And I got this call and I said, okay, I'll do a house call. And I'm not a superhero. I would take all the prophylactic, you know, ivermectin or whatever it is. And I was going to offer him my little supply, which was $370. Mm-hmm. If that's what I have to do. You know, I would try to be helpful. Went there. Yeah, he's probably got pneumonia and, you know, he was sick. Mm-hmm. And well, luckily in that one case, the wife had already got some horse gel, ivermectin from a vet. Apparently you just have to claim you have a horse or something. You can still get these. So all I needed to do was teach her how to use it. You know, how much is recommended and stuff. So that's just an example of my rather involvement. So I feel encouraged that no matter how my own family feel, but now, other than you, we can't really talk about it, right?
Yeah.
All the rest of the family, we talk about many things like this.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's one, that's like, well, since we are talking about it, I know, so like, I know there was a point where it felt strange to me and, hard. 'Cause like, so, as you kind of said before we started recording, like you were aware, like I was, the MD lead of our local vaccine clinic and that sort of thing. And I'm aware my parents aren't vaccinated and, that felt hard to me. It's interesting now. I mean, obviously you are autonomous human beings and get to make your own choices. And it felt difficult to me, that there was such a difference between us. And, I wonder what that was like from your perspective. Like you are seeing that I am following, the recommendations and I am getting vaccinated and vaccinating other people. I'm your daughter and like what was that like to have that difference be so prominent between us?
Well, I mean, I never asked you and I don't know if this is too kind of rough to open it up here. Mm-hmm. You remember one time we had a conversation when we babysat your first son and we were so looking forward babysitting your second son.
Yeah.
And then you decided not, you know, I'll put him in full-time daycare or something.
Yes.
I mean, I was really upset because that was when I actually bought a condo.
Yeah.
Close enough to your house to be even better at living our little dream of being good, glorified grandparent babysitters, right?
Yeah.
Especially your mom. I was very harsh on you. I said, like, you know, typical of me, and I said, you know, what's the evidence that the babysitter would do better than grandparents? And
yes, yeah.
All that, you know, rather nasty, you know, thing. It's not nice, right? You have a right to make decisions for your family, and there is no reason for me to even believe that you would make choices that are not good for your family. Right. But I mean, in my own mind is that, hey, I'm the one at risk. You know, I'm picking out a green, yellow gunk, you know, viruses, and I'm not afraid, you know. Right. So, but I mean, to be honest with you, at that point, then I was thinking that you're being a little bit too afraid, this whole thing, mm-hmm. to the extent that it's it's unreasonable. No, none of the kids under the age of 12 or something ever died. But they always remember some kids who are sick. But I mean, this is always the case. RSV viruses, kid end up in ICU, you always have that, right? But that's a very biased population. It's a very small population.
Yeah, I think it is true. Like, I reflect back on, for me, like, it's interesting, even using the words like rational or irrational. I think at this point, I don't even know what we mean by them. The thing I know is that, like, when I look back on what informed how I decided to follow or not follow, say, COVID-19 stuff at that time, it was based on fear and uncertainty, which is connected with fear, right? Of like, this seems big, this seems like it has a big impact, and sort of then it becomes who to trust. And it's interesting, like, I feel like I had a lot of sort of comfort from simply following the rules and simply, and like, I don't want to have to think it all the way through. I just want to follow what they're saying, because then otherwise it like spirals down into too much questioning. And I, you know what I mean? And I think it's interesting because like in a lot of other areas of my life, I have sort of, I no longer act that way where it's like, I'm just going to follow the rules. Like I, in so many other areas of my life, I'm not a big fan of doing that. So, yeah. And I think it gave me a kind of, empathy and understanding for why people do choose to sign up for a set of rules and follow them, you know, because when things feel uncertain or scary or confusing, there's something soothing about having a 10-point plan, you know?
And it's very common. You are part of a system, right? You have to trust, because there is not enough time in a day, especially the 15-minute appointment, to try to think through anything that you do.
Yeah.
A guideline has been helpful. That's why we have these computerized flow sheets and everything, you know. Yeah. I mean, I'm a part of that design of many of those things. It gives people at least some rough ideas. I mean, just example, you know, for the diabetic flow sheet thing, it highlights, okay, if you're going to only got a few minutes left, this, you know, the color would tell you do that first, because that has better evidence, right? So there is some, you know, I mean, the utility is hugely important to make your work at least, manageable, right? But if this continues, and I'm pointing to you my own experience, I'm part of the PBSG group with almost all faculty members, right? Yeah. Just because of where I work. I don't remember a single meeting we came together, study whatever topic. Someone would kind of throw down that piece of paper, that little paper, and say, it's time to quit. Because they are so discouraged that they can never meet up with all of these requirements.
You can't.
You know, most of these PBSC module begins with something like this. You know, this is a huge problem. Family doctors are not doing good enough. Mm-hmm. You are, you know, indirectly pointing, you're a big failure if you don't follow this guideline, right?
Yeah.
And my take has always been, like, how did you treat your patient? How did you, you know, how, some of these, they're just guidelines. Guidelines are just guidelines. Don't forget what is more important immediately, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have another resident, you know, super good, came in seeing an 80-year-old guy, and say she was concerned about his blood pressure. Let's say the blood pressure was 150 over 90, okay. And I said, no, you know, okay, ignore that for the moment. I'm not going to say ignore this completely, but I say you go back in and ask the patient how he's doing. His wife died a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She went back. I hope she would never forget it. The patient completely fell into pieces. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about, in terms of all the priorities, you do the best thing you can as a family doctor, okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to have some perspective, right? But she was probably afraid that I would point, as I'm sure many supervisors do. You mean you didn't change the medication or you didn't do this?
Yeah, right? What about the target?
Blah, blah, blah. The targets.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I mean, unfortunately, you know, you in your young career, you don't want to be like me. When you're in the, you know, when you're not following the main line narrative, you risk losing your career.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think that was a motivator for me. There was definitely a sense of, you know, well, if you didn't believe these things, if you didn't agree with public health recommendations, then you were the black sheep, you were out of the club, you were, right? Like, as you say, you experienced where people, and then those people, well, you and others, like, found their own community. So, like, there was the element of that. But I did later on, you know, like, at first I was like, I'm just following the guidelines. But, like, later on, like, I think that I just do hold a different, it's not even just a belief system, just like the way that I look at the evidence is different than you, you know? So, like, I think that is something that is interesting as well, that, like, people can look at the same evidence and come to different conclusions. Like, we see that even, I don't know, guidelines, they look at the same study and then the conclusions they come to seem opposite. So though the reasons I was so strict in following the rules exactly as they are, like, I was aware that underneath there was nuance, and underneath it wasn't like, you know, if I didn't wear a mask, I was immediately going to get COVID, or wearing a mask equaled I'd never get COVID. Like, I was aware it wasn't actually as strong as that, but my reading of the evidence still pointed me towards following it. Like, it, I sort of rounded up, you know what I mean? And it sounds, you rounded down, if you will. You know what I mean? So, I think that's important for me to say, is like, you know, though the fear was a guiding force for me, also, I did also look at the evidence and I did come to different conclusions. And I just think that that's interesting and can be really hard then. Say it's about something that doesn't matter. I don't know, like, which baseball team's going to win, or that's not something we'd ever talk about. I don't even know about baseball. But, you know, like, say it's like, oh, I think this thing is better than that thing. It doesn't matter. But, like, it's hard when we're looking at science in different ways. It's hard because it's supposed to be something that we can universally find truth in. And so it makes it challenging, you know?
Yeah, it is. Because we, you know, I learned this term, the tropics of medicine. It's like medicine is not as pure science as you like it to be.
Yeah.
It's like walking into a forest trying to find your way out, right?
Yes.
And it is true for doctors. It is even more so for patients.
Yes.
I constantly listen to stories of people who've gone through just a lot, trying to figure out what they should do to look out themselves, right?
Yeah.
Especially when they have super health challenges. And it's very, very difficult. So, yeah, I mean, well, you have a very supportive family, and then you are seen in the family as decision maker in this area, and that's fine, because, I mean, I've seen family when husband and wife disagree on it, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you know, in this particular situation, I think luckily the husband is the one who is more, let's say, of my thinking about it. The wife, unfortunately, is in family medicine. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you deal with that, right?
Yeah. I'm sure it was a huge strain on a lot of relationships. It probably broke up relationships. Like,
and they're not even medical family. I mean, he's a teacher, very bright guy, and he chooses to read all kinds of alternative news media. And the more he hears, the more he's just angry at the government. Now, he's from England, so He doesn't feel strongly about a Canadian government. Yep. But I'm just saying, he just, you know, whether he had the training to understand and totally, but he has very, very strong view. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when he was put on leave, right, because of rejecting a vaccine, right?
Right.
I mean, the likelihood of anybody getting a vaccine is not going to be like, you know, some of the sad cases where, you know, one of my colleagues suddenly died in her 50s. She was a picture of health. And you cannot help but to try to understand what's going on. And this happened to two of my other colleagues. One is in 60s and one is in the mid-70s. Getting cancer of completely, you know, with no risk factors. And they are fast. Boom. Diagnosis to death is 3 months. Like that, right?
It sort of goes to what we were just saying before, right? Like, you can hear those stories, and then people are going to draw different conclusions from what that means, right? Like, and yeah. So for you, it might raise more suspicion about the vaccine, and for someone else, they come to a different conclusion. And, you know, it's hard to say what these individual cases could mean.
Well, yeah. Can we veer away from your questions?
I was mostly curious about the sort of emotional, relational impact of these differences of opinion. And I feel like we did hear that as well, but if there's anything else you want to share.
I don't know how wide your audience are, whether this is going to bring any blowback. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you get people writing back to you about.
Oh, sometimes, but I mean, we'll see. It's okay.
Yeah, I mean, with our lecture, people actually, they don't write back. They're being nice, but mm-hmm. we got a phone call from a colleague in London mm-hmm. who said that so-and-so said they were really hurt by your lecture. This is a bit bizarre, right? And these two were actually McMaster graduates from, you know, working in St. Catherine. And I just thought, well, why don't you tell me straight in the face? Then I would try to explain why I said what I said. Yeah. Was there anything that is not from the data? You know, I mean, but I mean, the whole emotional thing is oh, you're causing vaccine hesitancy, right?
Yeah.
And this person from London, very well respected, you know, very pro-life movement and all that. She's a family doctor, and her husband is a specialist. Also graduated the same program I graduated from McMaster, mm-hmm. you know, the DM&E, clinical epidemiology. We're quite proud of that degree. I mean, it's internationally recognized degree. And he looked at the same data. He came to a completely different conclusion.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Trusts her husband rather than trusting me, even though we were trained at the same place.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Totally. That's some of what I've sort of reflected on since that period of time is just like how science can be kind of wielded in ways that are emotional, and that it's hard to hold space for a difference of opinion. I know. So for me, I found it so hard to see that you thought so differently. So I definitely did distance myself from you, and I asked you not to talk about it because it felt like you were hurting my feelings, kind of similar to how it was like with that couple that they felt hurt by your lecture. And it's interesting for me to interrogate that because like you're simply stating your view. You're simply stating what, like you didn't say, Joan, you're a piece of garbage. Like you didn't even say something insulting to me. You were sharing what you thought and believed, and the fact that I was feeling hurt or scared or whatever by it, that was interesting for me to like explore for myself. I think it speaks to the unhelpful belief that the only way you can be in relationship with people is to agree with each other on everything.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you should have seen when your mom and I prepared these lectures. We're so careful not to be pushing our view. All we said is that this is what the data show, And this is a good way of understanding how safe it is or whatever, right? By actual calculations. But I'm sure we're not perfect human beings. You know, even when I'm talking about it, my expression probably gives away by saying, if you don't believe in this, you're a fool, right? I mean, I don't know.
Because well, you have to, your right? position. You like everyone has their bias that they're coming from. Like everyone is going to speak from their experience. Well, thanks, Dad. Yeah, is there anything else that you wanted to say? Was that the main? Were those the main points that you wanted to share?
Yeah, mostly right now it's not an issue, right? I mean, we love it when we chat, when we see each other. You know, we just never mention the word COVID. You know, just to keep peace, and it's already not an issue.
And
although from time to time I would think that, you know, to get our grandchildren to have more shots, it's just a bit insane. But I mean, I just don't know what to say. We keep reminding ourselves we are not the parents, right?
Yeah.
That's all we say. Even slipping this into this conversation just to reflect, right? Mm-hmm. Probability is on our side, or we say a religious word is that God is on our side. You can't control anything. You know, who has problem, who's not. Anyway, so I'm so glad we have this conversation. You know, never in my dreams do I, you know, go to med school. You know, the audience may not know I was an engineer and I was, happy
with
that.
We told them last time.
Yeah, and then into this, and then into that, and actually, you know, my one very proud moment was to be able to help you, you know, graduate, put the hood on you. That picture is always there. Not because I take it as a proof that I've done something right, but I was just so happy that you guys are all doing so well. Mm-hmm. You know, so anyways.
Thanks, Dad.
Okay.
I think we'll just end it there then. That works.
Okay.
Hello again. So that concludes my conversation with my dad. I would love to hear what you think of it, honestly. This series is a more vulnerable one for me than even my usual series where I'm like crying to the camera or whatever. I talk a lot about personal and human impacts on this podcast because I really believe in the power of humanizing ourselves and telling human stories. And that is one of the ways that I want to contribute to humanizing healthcare culture as a whole. And this one, you know, feels extra tender, if you can imagine. So if you have any thoughts at all, good, bad, or ugly, I would love to hear from you either, you know, through my website or on Instagram or whatever, please feel free to share. But I also then wanted to share just even for myself, spend some time reflecting on what this conversation meant to me and the themes that I noticed coming up for myself as I was having the conversation with my dad. I think the first thing I want to say is that I feel a lot of gratitude to my dad for being willing to have the conversation. You know, it could feel vulnerable to publicly talk about some of his beliefs and his views, knowing that not everyone is going to view them favorably. And so I'm grateful that he's willing to do that for me and for you guys. I also feel very grateful for my past self, like all the versions of myself that's gotten me to this point, where I feel and felt capable of actually having this conversation. Like I said in like the intro bit I did before the conversation, I was really a little bit devastated when I realized that my parents held different views than I did during COVID-19 pandemic. And I think it was based on the fact that we also hold many differing, if not fully opposing, views on many other things that are deeply important to us. And so it felt painful for this to be yet another thing, and especially the thing that
the entire world was obsessed with and consumed by, and like all colleagues and all patients were all talking about all the time. And so one way that I chose to help myself with that pain at the time was to ask them not to talk to me about it. Like I asked both of them, don't send me your links, your emails. I'm not interested in having like engagement or discussion or debate about it. I couldn't be objective about it with them. And I still am very grateful for doing that. I'm grateful for my past self for being very dogmatic and legalistic and rigid with COVID guidelines, because it is what I felt I needed to do at the time. So I don't have any, I want to make it clear, I'm not sure if it was clear from the conversation, but I have no regrets about that, even if I would, I currently do make different choices in that, like, I don't wear a mask everywhere. I used a more nuanced risk assessment when deciding things, in part because the context of our world is different and because I'm different. But I am still grateful that Past Jones set those boundaries at that time, because it's what I needed to do to hold on to myself in the midst of that. And I think part of that is then why I now feel capable of reopening the door for conversations like this. And I just wanted to name all of that because, you know, maybe someone listening is in a difficult spot in a relationship and they're feeling like they might need to set firmer boundaries or not, or be questioning things. And I mean, the main thing is like doing what feels right in the moment in a way that is you choosing yourself leads you back to other people. When I was in a pattern of chronically feeling like I had to choose other people over myself and betray myself in order to get the love, respect, status, be a good daughter, for example, it doesn't end up serving even that relationship, even if it feels like it does on the surface. And so I am so grateful that I made hard choices then, even choices that were upsetting, as you heard a little bit, like we're upsetting to my parents, were upsetting to me in some ways, but now it's leading us to a different place. And I don't know where that place actually is, right? Like we're all in process here, but I can't imagine having the conversation I had with my dad, honestly, even maybe 6 months ago, certainly like a few years ago, it would have been too upsetting to hear his opinions. But now I can see that his opinions are his and hold on to mine, and feel sort of on equal footing. And that's taken a lot of work. I could talk all about all the work it's taken. A lot of these podcasts, especially the ones about people pleasing and fawning and stuff, are kind of all about that. So I just feel very, very proud to like kind of be in the setting, and to have done that and to have had those conversations with him, and just feeling gratitude for my past self. And like I said, for my dad too, and you know, his journey that's allowed him to come here and not also be attacking or upset with me for not agreeing with him, right? So hooray to us both, in different ways for this specific conversation. Some other things that I noticed coming up was like still some of the inhuman stories that like live inside of me. Like I would notice rising up in me tension about like how there are times he would be talking, like especially in that second conversation, there's a whole section where he's talking about like family medicine, that like we can't always follow the guidelines. Like he's saying things that I literally say on this podcast all the time. And I see so much of myself, and how I think, I know I received it from him, or at least I've come to the same conclusions as him. And there's this tension of like, how can I agree with him so strongly about certain aspects and yet really not be coming to the same conclusions about other aspects in medicine and outside of medicine? And there's this instinct that I'm supposed to either say he's all wrong or all right, like he's all good or all bad. And I know that's a protective instinct, and there's times in which, depending on the context, like that needs to kind of happen, the boundaries need to be set, and then, you know, all of that stuff. But like for me, I think the humanizing invitation is to notice, like, I don't think there's humans on this planet that all agree about everything all the time. And everyone gets to decide what kind of relationship they have with any other human on this planet. And I'm finding it freeing to consider the notion I can be in strong agreement on some beliefs and being in complete opposite agreement, disagreement with other beliefs. And all of that can coexist. It can all coexist within a relationship and doesn't necessarily have to mean that anything's gone wrong. And so I'm like witnessing that was sort of coming up for me and was helpful for me to kind of think through after the conversations were had. Yeah. And then just like this sort of fear of someone listening to my conversation with my dad and thinking that I should have, you know, debated him back or fact checked him more, whatever that would even mean, or, you know, that there's something harmful about having him share his experience because it includes his beliefs, which, like he says, you know, he says he's aware that people think that having those beliefs increases vaccine hesitancy, right? So there was a part of me that's like, oh no, people are going to be mad at me for viewing this conversation. And so like for that part of myself, I think the main thing is that's a part of myself that I know I've been healing for a long time. Like one of the works of this podcast in general is to continue to grow in my ability to feel like authentic in myself and know myself and be in integrity with myself and embody my values. And if people are angry, upset about that, I can like hold space for that. So say, for example, you're having that reaction and you're like, I can't believe you aired that or something. Please feel free to share your emotions with me. It's okay. Because I feel like what I've edited in and out, I think the final product, I feel good about it. Still sharing my dad's individual human experience, which does include some of the things that he thinks and the things that he's read and the conclusions he's come to and the people he's listened to or whatever, right? Like it includes all of that. But the thing I wanted to center, and I hope you get the sense that I wanted to center, is like his humanity in it, as well as my own, and how humans in relationship bounce off each other and are messy with each other, right? So yeah, those were just some final thoughts I wanted to share, but I really would love to hear from you. So yeah, like I said at the beginning of this, please reach out to me, email me, contact me through my website, joanchanmd.com, @joanchanmd on Instagram. I would love to hear your thoughts on how this episode landed with you. And yeah, with that, I'll talk to you next week. I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work in healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.